The joint meeting of the House and Senate Judiciary Committees will come to order. It is now 1:30 p.m., Wednesday, January 27th, in the state capitol. My name is Gabrielle Ledoux. I am the House Judiciary Chair, and I will be chairing this meeting. And so we'll begin. Senator McGuire, would you like to begin by introducing your members?
Absolutely. Good morning. I defer to Madam Chair since we're in her room, and it's the body closest to the people. Here present for the record from the Senate Judiciary Committee is Senator Costello and Senator Coghill, my vice chair.
And my members are so far Representative Lynn, and again, I'm Gabrielle Ledoux, the chair of the committee. So before we begin, I'd like to thank Christy Blair, the House Judiciary Secretary, and Matt Kern from the Juneau LIO, who will be making sure that we have sound and a transcript of our committee meeting today. Today we will be hearing a presentation on the Alaska Criminal Justice Commission's Justice Reinvestment Report and Recommendations. Suzanne DiPietro, Executive Director of the Alaska Judicial Council, will begin the presentation and will be joined by Jeff Jesse, CEO of the Alaska Mental Health Trust, when he gets out of House Finance today. Members have a copy of the PowerPoint presentation on their desk to follow along. Ms. Pietro, my script says please come forward, but you're already there, so I won't ask you to do that. Put yourself on the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Suzanne DiPietro for the record, and I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Judicial Council. And as you mentioned, I'm pinch-hitting a little bit for Jeff Jesse, who is a member of the Criminal Justice Commission. He should be here soon, and then I will turn the presentation over to him.
And before you begin, I noticed that Senator Wilikowski has joined us. So welcome.
So I'm going to talk to you about the Justice Reinvestment Report, which is this report here, that was issued on December, just last month. And the report covers a number of different areas. And really what it's about is recommendations about how to make Alaskan families and communities safer, how to hold criminal offenders accountable, most importantly, how to curb the skyrocketing costs of corrections, and how the state of Alaska can get a better return on its public safety dollar investment. So the commission received information about the problems facing Alaska. It received information about the cost of doing nothing, in other words, the cost of not undertaking any criminal justice reform, trends in Alaska's prison population that the state needs to look out for, and it concluded with recommendations for Alaska's lawmakers. So I want to talk a little bit about prison growth in Alaska, and so this will be laying out the problem statement, and then in the second part of the presentation we'll get into the solutions.
And just 1 minute, I'd like to note for the record that Representative Grunberg has joined us. Continue.
So the problem is that prison growth in Alaska is growing and has been growing, up 27% in the last 10 years. The cost of corrections is around $300 million a year, and we can see from this graph that if these current trends continue, in other words, if we do nothing, we are going to end up with around 6,500 prisoners in the next few years. And the cost of those increased beds or increased prisoners would be around $169 million. Now, one of the things about this population growth in the prisons is people say, well, isn't the population of Alaska increasing? Yes, but the prison population is increasing three times faster than the population in Alaska. So it's not as a result of population growth in Alaska. State spending on corrections has gone up 60% over the last 20 years. And we have information that Alaskans are not getting a good public safety return on our investment. Why? Because studies by the Alaska Judicial Council and others have indicated that almost 2 out of 3 offenders who go into prison and then are released come back to to prison within 3 years. So that is not a good outcome, and frankly, I think everyone in this room thinks that we can do better, and I know the commission members think that we can do better, and this report is about how can we do better.
Ms. Pietro, is the prison population rising because we've made more things, more offenses subject to prison, or is it rising because law enforcement has been doing a better job of catching people?
It's rising for three reasons, and I think of these reasons as before, during, and after incarceration. So the before reason is that the pretrial population is increasing, and that's our biggest increase. 81% of people has – the pretrial population has risen 81%. So that's people who are being held before they've been convicted, people being held pretrial who are not able to make bail, and they're being held in the taking up prison beds. That's 28% of the population. And those pretrial detainees are staying longer. So what is the difference between now and before? They're staying longer than they used to. So that's the before. The during is the sentence. Yes.
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Pietro, I know other states and scholars have looked at that problem and have found constitutional problems with that, because it results in the poor going to jail without a trial. Has your research focused at all in that area, and if not, should it?
Well, as a part of the commission's work, the Judicial Council was able to do research that's been done for the very first time ever in Alaska, looking at actually going into the paper court files and looking at who is detained pretrial and for how long, and that information was all given to the commission, and that information all went into the report. So there are a variety of issues with pretrial detention, and I'll talk a little bit about those later. But really, the main thing to remember is our pretrial release system right now is related to money. Most people in Alaska who go before a judge for a bail hearing receive a money bail. In other words, they have to put up some amount of money in order to be released. And so in that way, Alaska's bail system is related to how much you can pay. So the commission received information, research from other places showing that how much you can pay is not necessarily related to whether you are risky and should or should not be released. I think we can all think of people who are probably very risky who can come up with money to be released, and we can probably also think of people who are very low risk, who are not going to hurt anybody, who cannot come up with money, and then they stay detained. So the thrust of the commission's recommendations on pretrial is that instead of relating release to money, we would relate it to risk. So
may I follow up with one question?
Yes.
Nice answer, but didn't get to my question. Have you done any legal research on the constitutionality of that?
Of a money bail system?
Yep.
No.
Thank you.
Through the chair.
Sorry. Senator Coghill?
Just that in our Constitution, a bail is required. And so it's just a matter of where it's applied or how it's applied. And so we are, under our Constitution, bail specific. So as we go through the process, we'll be able to show you how that has been applied in Alaska and how we could do better.
That would be helpful. Thank you.
So those are the people who are pretrial. So then there's the sentenced population, and those are the people that we normally think of as being in prison, people who've been convicted and have received a sentence. One of the things the commission learned about our sentenced population, and by the way, I should say that the assessment that was done, the study of our system from top to bottom, was the most thorough probably that's been done in several decades in Alaska. And that was so all this information, although little bits and pieces of it may have been apparent, this is the first really comprehensive full-scale assessment that's been done in decades, and it's been, I think the commissioners found it quite eye-opening. So felony offenders, for one category, they are staying longer, 31% longer than they did 10 years ago. So that's what's driving the increase in the sentenced population by and large. And then the third category of problems has to do with people who have already served their sentence and they've been released, and they're out on probation or parole, and they're being supervised by and large. And they can be, they have rules that they have to follow, and they can be returned to prison for violating those rules. Well, it turns out that 22% of the people in our prisons right now are people who've been returned to prison because they violated rules of probation or parole. And most of those, though, were technical violations. And technical violations are things like, not new crimes, but things like having a dirty drug test, failing to come to an appointment, failing to maintain a job. So not new criminal activity, but what we call technical violations. So those are...
Ms. Pietro, since most drugs are controlled substances, wouldn't having a dirty drug test actually, since you don't end up with a dirty drug test unless you've taken something that you're not supposed to be taking, wouldn't that actually be a new crime?
Madam Chair, it could be charged as a new crime, but typically it's treated as a violation of probation or parole.
Thank you. And I noticed that we have been joined by Senator Michicki. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a bill in committee. I apologize.
You can continue.
One other fact that I think is important to understand about the people in Alaska's prisons is that three-quarters of those who are entering our prisons are actually convicted of nonviolent offenses. So again, I think many of us had thought of prison as a place where violent offenders were contained, and of course there are violent offenders there, but really the eye-opening thing I think for the commission was how many people in prison are actually in there for nonviolent offenses. So I've been mentioning the commission. Let me just give you a little bit of information about the commission. The commission was created by the legislature in Senate Bill 64, July of 2014. Its mandate is to evaluate and make recommendations involving criminal laws and practices, and keeping in mind really the important goals of public safety, offender rehabilitation, victim restitution, and reducing costs. And the legislature created a 13-member commission, and I'm just going to take a couple of minutes to talk about who's on the commission, because I think you'll see that the people who are on the commission say a lot about how the commissioners were able to come up with such a comprehensive set of recommendations. So from the legislative branch, we have, of course, our very own Senate Majority Leader John Coghill and Representative Wes Keller. From the judicial branch, three judges, one who was an appellate judge and a district court judge and a superior court judge. From the commissioner of the Department of Corrections, three law enforcement officials, and that would be the attorney general, the commissioner of the Department of Public Safety, and Lieutenant Chris Sell from the Juneau Police Department. And she was a very active and very helpful member on the commission. Also, Public Defender Quinlan Steiner, and an important seat was filled by Greg Razzo, who works at Cook Inlet Region, Inc., and he is the commission's chair right now, and I know that he very much wanted to be here to address you today, but he had already spent a couple of days down here away from his work and needed to return to Anchorage, so I know that he would love to talk to you more. Also, an important seat was filled for crime victims, and that was filled by Brenda Stanfill, the Interior Alaska Center for Nonviolent Living, and then, of course, from the Alaska Mental Health Trust, Jeff Jesse. So those are were the commissioners. You can see that they come from a variety of different perspectives and positions. And just yesterday at the Lunch and Learn, Lieutenant Sell said that she was surprised during the process to agree with Quinlan Steiner, the public defender, on a number of issues in this report. And that is really the theme of this report, that once the commission decided, as they did, to let the data and studies and experiences, documented experiences in other states, drive their deliberations and their recommendations, it became easier to come to consensus. And they did come to consensus on 21 different recommendations that are very comprehensive. If this package of recommendations, the 21 recommendations, are adopted and become law, they are projected to save around $424 million over the next 10 years. And some of that savings is actual, what would we call it? I guess we could call it averted savings. And some of that is actual savings from reductions in the prison population.
Senator Cockham had a question, and I'd like to note for the record that Representative Mellett has joined us.
Thank you. And this is not a question, but before we leave the point of the commission, the discussion on the bill that created the commission was where would you house the work of the commission, and would it be in the administration, in the legislature? And what was chosen was the Judicial Council, and that's one of the reasons why you'll have Suzanne DiPietro presenting today, is because they helped manage the discussion, they facilitated the meetings, they helped reach into agencies, and then we had the Pew organization working as a helper in that very issue. But the Judicial Council, significant part of it because they helped manage, maintain, and set up meetings, unpack the meetings, and reform it. So I just didn't want it to go unnoticed that the Judicial Council had a significant part in this. It's just that they got to listen to the commissioners, figure out how to deal with these issues, but they set up the conversation in many ways. So thank you.
You can proceed.
Thank you, Senator Coghill. So, yes, the Judicial Council, I just wanted to, I should say that one of the council's constitutional duties is to conduct studies to improve the administration of justice. And, you know, as the executive director, I would like to just say that we've been very thrilled to be involved in this effort and hope that we can continue to be of assistance. Senator Coghill also mentioned the Pew Charitable Trusts, their Public Safety Performance Project. I think some of you may have seen a presentation or heard of their work. They provided a great deal of technical assistance, and so it was really the research and technical assistance was really very much a partnership between the experts from Pew and our own expertise right here in Alaska, and really terrific effort by particularly Department of Corrections and other agencies that were asked to give data, to contribute data to the process. And as I mentioned before, some of the questions that were asked data-wise were things that really had never been studied in any systematic way. I'd also like to just talk briefly about the commission process. I know I mentioned that it was a consensus process, but I would not want it to go unnoticed that the commission was involved in a great deal of outreach. So the commission traveled to Nome and Kotzebue and had roundtables there, visited the prison there, spoke to prisoners, spoke to correctional officers. The commission members had numerous meetings, over 50 meetings. These were all public meetings advertised, and a number of people, members of the public and others, would come to the meetings and contribute. The commissioners also sponsored two victim roundtables. That's very important because the commission is very concerned about the perspectives and priorities of victims in Alaska. One of those roundtables was in Fairbanks, and one was in Bethel. And a report was generated from those roundtables, and that's on the Judicial Council website under the Criminal Justice Commission tab.
And before you go any further, Senator Wielichowski has got a question.
Has the definition of nonviolent offender changed at all over the years? And how are you defining nonviolent offender when you say that 75% of the people in prison are nonviolent offenders?
Through the chair, I don't know that the definition has changed. A nonviolent offender is somebody who was not convicted of a person crime, so that's how it was defined. So, for example, somebody who was convicted of a drug offense is a nonviolent offender. Somebody who is convicted of DUI, for example, that would be an alcohol offender and would not be a violent offender in this category. You can categorize things in a number of different ways, but I think what the commission was trying to get at, I think what we're all trying to get at, is this idea that if an offender who has committed a violent act against another person or an act that puts another person physically at risk would be a violent offender.
No. Okay. Is the definition that you use for nonviolent offender similar to the definitions that are used in most other states?
For purposes of this analysis, yes.
Thank you.
So one other thing that I would like to mention is a charge that the commissioners received that they took very seriously from the legislative leadership, and I've got excerpts of that letter up on the screen right now. The legislative leadership asked the commission to come up with recommendations that would reduce the prison population by either, well, the first one, I guess, was averting all future prison growth. The second request was to reduce the current prison population by 15%, and the third request was to reduce it by 25%. So those were the goalposts set, and the commissioners took that very seriously and thought very hard in their recommendations about how can we get to the 15, the 20, the 25% reductions while preserving public safety. And so one of the things that I think is important to remember is this was not an exercise in just saving money or emptying out prisons. This was an exercise in making recommendations that could reduce the prison population while preserving public safety by reducing recidivism. So it's really two sides of the same coin. You want to reduce recidivism. You do not want to just let people out in a revolving door and have them reoffend. So this next slide, just is a quick overview of the commission process, which I mentioned before, the system assessment that was very extensive, and again, first time it's been done in this comprehensive way in decades. Pew also brought research from other states. The commission engaged in site visits and roundtables. So, in other words, getting not just the research from other states, but getting the input from the experts in Alaska, the people who do the work in Alaska. And then, because these areas are so complex, the commission broke itself into three work groups in each of the three categories that I sort of started out mentioning. What in my mind I think of as the before, during, and after, so the pretrial, the sentenced, and the post-conviction population. And it was, as I mentioned, a consensus process. So I'm just going to provide a broad overview of the recommendations in the report, kind of the 10,000-foot view, because I think it would be tedious to go through all 21 policy recommendations, although I know that the commissioners would make themselves available to all of you to discuss these recommendations. So I'm just going to talk about a few categories or principles that the commission that the commissioners heard about in the research and the outreach that they did. So the first sort of principle was that it would be better to safely release and supervise defendants while they are waiting for their trial. Can we safely release and supervise nonviolent pretrial defendants while they wait for their trial? That's at 28% of people. Can we reduce that number? The second one is the second principle that the commissioners really embraced was can we divert low-level nonviolent offenders away from prison and to other types of interventions? So, for example, community-based interventions, community-based supervision, non-prison alternatives like in confinement in CRCs or electronic monitoring. And the idea there, again, is that the principle would be that we really are expensive prison beds. We want to preserve them as much as possible for the more violent offenders who need longer and more strict supervision.
Senator Kakia.
Just to interrupt you on the acronyms that we get so used to, CRCs means...
So, through the chair, yes, a community residential center is a CRC. Another principle was they took a look at this the sentencing laws. And remember, I mentioned earlier that the sentences for felons had gone up quite a bit over the past 10 years. And so the thought was, could the sentences that are on the books for felons be brought more into line with sentences from other states, or really be brought more into line with how they were in Alaska in previous years? Then on the community supervision side of things, so when the offenders are released, And really almost all of them are released. So the idea is they're going to get out. We'd like them, when they get out, to be monitored and assisted to become productive members of society instead of just let out to reoffend. So a principle there was to impose swift and certain sanctions for people who are released who violate their conditions of probation or parole. And finally, the commission made recommendations about how to strengthen supervision in the community. So some of the mechanisms that the Department of Corrections community probation officers are using now could be strengthened so that they could respond more appropriately to people who are out in the community. Well, I got a little bit behind on my... And I want to talk a little bit about the reinvestment. So there's this reinvestment in the title. What did the commission mean by reinvestment? So an important, really critical part of this package is if the legislature were to adopt this package, there would be savings. However, some of these recommendations will not really have the outcomes that we think they're going to have unless there's a modest amount of reinvestment in resources. So I'll give you one example. If it makes sense to release nonviolent, non-high-risk defendants while they're waiting for their trials to try to free up part of that 28% of the beds right now that they're taking up, there have to be more tools in the community for assessing their risk and for supervising them if they are deemed to need supervision pre-trial. So one of the recommendations is to reinvest in community supervision for pre-trial services. Those recommendations about letting those pre-trial defendants wait for their trials out in the community instead of in a hard prison bed, those don't work so well unless there's a way to assess their risk. So that would be a reinvestment piece. And the commission, I think, really emphasizes that the reinvestment, it's a modest portion of the savings, is very important, really critical to this whole thing holding together. So in the same way that the 21 recommendations really work together as a package, the reinvestment piece is critical to get the outcomes. We wouldn't want to change the law and not get the outcomes that we're entitled to. In other words, not get better outcomes.
So, Ms. Pietro, would the folks that are being considered for pretrial release, would they be only nonviolent offenders, or would we be talking about people who have not been convicted but have been charged with a violent crime also?
So, Madam Chair, the commission received information actually from a few other states who have done a lot of really pioneering work in something called pretrial risk assessment. And it's been discovered through kind of, I guess I would say, actuarial analysis, and really kind of in the same way that an insurance company looks at you and gets a few pieces of data about you and can decide whether you're a good risk to insure or not. It turns out that you can perform a similar kind of assessment of people in the criminal justice system, and you can make very good predictions about whether they're risky or not. And so some of it, as I understand it, would be based on what type of offense they're charged with, but some of it would be based on their criminal history. Some of it there would be a lot of factors that would go into the risk assessment. And I think the point is that we don't do that here now. Other states do it. They're having pretty good results. So one of the recommendations is that we should try doing some pretrial risk assessment here in Alaska and develop a pretrial risk assessment tool that would work for us. It would have to be completely tailored to Alaska, because the one that works in Kentucky is probably not going to be good enough for Alaska.
Thank you.
I'll just put the two things that the commission, and I got to be in on some of this discussion, so I know it somewhat. Right now, bail is the question, and bail is probably arbitrary if you consider it across Alaska. This would probably give a tool that showed risk of not showing and risk to the public safety. And so those are the two major risk factors. People are assumed innocent until proven guilty, but there are risks, and that's one of the reasons why we keep some people in jail. Mm-hmm. And so bail has been available to people with very high risk right now. So this would probably put a very, very different approach on how we view the pretrial population, which I think is good. And this is where Pew came in and brought to us from all over America places where this has been got proven practices. So I think as we move from this introduction into kind of deeper level, you'll see that this is data-driven, shows some pretty good outcomes. Anyway, I just wanted to add my little two cents. I happen to be on a pretrial group, so I probably know it better than most of the other.
Thank you. Senator Maciejewski?
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, Senator Wilikowski's question was sort of interesting to me, and your answer was as well. I mean, when you talk about violent or nonviolent criminals, is there a sort of a spreadsheet of how you divide that up? Because a repeat offender person with a lot of DUIs, in my view, is a violent criminal just because of the potential. Or someone with drug offenses to the point where they endanger their family because of abuse or neglect. So it's not that simple, is it?
Through the chair, I think what you're saying makes a lot of sense. And when we talk, so you have to, Pew, when they analyzed Department of Corrections records, had to categorize things as violent or nonviolent or alcohol or theft or property offenses, alcohol offenses, nonviolent or person offenses. So they had to make categories in order to do this analysis. And that might be a little bit different than risk. So a person who had committed a couple of DUIs would, as I understand the way Pew categorized things for purposes of analyzing who's in prison right now, that would have been in the category of alcohol offenses. Whether or not that person who had done that when they came up for, let's say, pretrial release, or maybe they came for parole or probation, they might be assessed as high risk. So if that makes sense, they're not necessarily the same thing. And so when I was talking about the categories of people in prison, those were categories that Pew did to sort of help the commission understand what crimes people had committed while they were in prison. And that does not necessarily say how risky those people would be.
Follow up, Madam Chair. When you talked about the proportion of people that are nonviolent criminals in our prisons, it leaves the impression that most of us would support them not serving in a brick-and-mortar prison, but that's not the case. Many of those that fall into the nonviolent category are very high risk to folks outside of the institution. So that's kind of the reason for my confusion, I think.
Through the chair, if I may, I think that's a very good point, and it actually leads me to something that I haven't spoken about yet, which is this issue of substance abuse. So I think we know that so many of the people who go in and out, who cycle in and out of our correctional facilities, have substance abuse problems, drug possession or dealing, but really a lot of drug possession, a lot of alcohol problems, and the commission received a lot of information about that, and that is why one of the main points that the commission made is that treatment for substance abuse needs to be an alternative. So if you're not going to confine people with substance abuse problems in prison because it's quite expensive, the alternative is not to just leave them out in the community. The alternative has to be to provide treatment, to give them access to treatment so that the underlying problem can be addressed. And Lieutenant Sell just talked about this at the Lunch and Learn yesterday, and you know, she just reported from her own experience arresting the same people over and over and over again, these quote-unquote low-level offenders who are using substances, and the feeling that they're cycling in and out of prison, they're not getting treatment in prison, typically misdemeanors, don't stay long enough to get the drug and alcohol treatment in prison. Then they come back out. They're not supported in the community. They go right back to their same old habits, and then Lieutenant Sell has to arrest them again. And I think the frustration from law enforcement is that cycle. And is there anything we can do to break that cycle? Well, obviously, with a 64% recidivism rate right now, we're not breaking that cycle. Could there be another way? And research shows, and this is what the commission was sort of was going on, is that research shows that when people receive treatment for their underlying problems, they can desist from criminal behavior. So that's the principle there, and there has to be treatment available. You don't. I would hate for folks to think that the idea is just to give them shorter sentences and just set them off in the community, because that would just make the revolving door shorter. So we have a revolving door now. We don't want to make it shorter. We want to stop the revolving. And then a third.
Senator Wilikowski, and then Representative Grunberg.
Thank you. I think this is a very important discussion to have. And if we've got to provide treatment for these people, if we want to have a system where we're going to reduce their sentences, the thing that frustrates me and the thing that frustrates my constituents is when you hear about someone who has been arrested literally 30 times, 50 times for a variety of offenses, a lot of times substance abuse related, mm-hmm. And then finally they kill someone. And I think it's critical that if we're going to make a serious effort about this, we've got to focus attention on substance abuse treatment. But I think there are going to be people who, for whatever reason, we're not going to be able to help and we're not going to be able to fix. And those are the people that need to be locked up to protect society. And I just don't want us to lose sight of that. Because I'm constantly frustrated reading the reports about people who've been arrested dozens of times, and they're still out, and they're still hurting people.
Through the chair, I think certainly the law enforcement members of the commission would agree completely with that they're frustrated as well. They're arresting the same people over and over. Even the correctional officers are seeing the same people cycle through without some way to intervene. And there are ways. We have therapeutic courts. Those could be used more. The commission talked a lot about substance abuse treatment in the community. Yes, there needs to be treatment in the facilities, but particularly in the community for these folks, many of whom probably, if offered the opportunity, would want to become more productive members of society. So it's exactly right. It's a tough, and I don't want to sit here and say that it's not a very, very hard problem. It is. But really other, you know, the studies really do show that for some of these people, keeping them longer in prison does not decrease recidivism. In other words, does not cause them to desist from criminal behavior. What causes them to desist from criminal behavior more likely is to address their underlying problem, which would be usually substance abuse or mental health or both. And
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you. And you finished your answer?
Yes.
Okay. A few minutes ago, Mr. DiPietro, you mentioned that a lot of the people are in because of petition to revoke PTR probation. And I think you said 60% or something like that.
Through the chair, no, it's about around a quarter of the people in prison on any given day.
And really what we're dealing with there, it sounds to me, one major category is failure to keep appointments.
Through the chair, that is one kind of technical violation.
Focusing on that, did your commission look at other ways of making sure people keep their appointments?
Through the chair, actually, the commission did see research showing that, this is one of my favorite pieces of research, showing that people are more likely to keep their appointments, and actually in this context it was that keep their court date, if they receive a telephone or text or email reminder. And I think maybe we all experienced that through our medical providers who have figured this out maybe without looking at the research. And so that actually is one of the recommendations in the report to institute a reminder system about court date appearances.
That could even be automated.
It, through the chair, it would need to be automated, I would think, yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Continue, please.
And then the last reinvestment issue or sort of resource in the community issue that I wanted to mention is very important to the commission, really I almost should have said it first, was services to prevent violence and to support victims. So the commission was very concerned with advancing victim priorities. As I mentioned, came out with a report that specifically cataloged the victim priorities that came out of the roundtables. And one of the main concerns in the victims' community, and therefore one of the main concerns of the commission, was that victims be supported, that resources be available. And actually many victims would wish to see prevention, would wish that there could be prevention services so that there would be no fewer, so that there would be fewer victims, so that they would, they want their, obviously the people who are already victimized need services, but many would wish that, that prevention could be supported so that there would be no more victims. So that's a very important part of the commission's recommendation. And again, the savings from keeping people as much as possible out, from identifying people who really could be contained and rehabilitated outside of an institution, the savings from that could be reinvested, and it's a very important piece of this package. So I'm going to hopefully show you a chart here that shows the predictions that the commission came up with for the package. So that green line that's dipping below is, if this package is adopted, that is the commission's projections of how many prison beds would be saved over the next few years. And that's a 21% reduction. And you'll recall the charge from the legislative leadership, the letter that the commission received with the request to hit reductions of 15% or 25%. The commission came up with a 21% projected bed reduction in the prison population, and that would generate, according to the commission's calculations, around $424 million in savings for the state.
And that is over a 10-year period, did you say?
Correct, over a 10-year period, 2024, actually, 2024. One type of support services I haven't mentioned is reentry services. I think the commission heard about the Department of Corrections activities in trying to strengthen what is called reentry, and that is just a pretty simple concept. One of the interesting things that the research by the Judicial Council and nationally has shown is that when people are released from prison, most of them who are returned to prison, whether for a new offense or for a technical violation, are returned within the first 3 months. So they get out and then they go typically right back. And within the first year, almost every person who is going to reoffend or get sent back to prison has gone back. So that was a real, I think, eye-opener to many, this idea that it's when they first are released that they misstep. And so the idea is, can there be reentry support and services for those people who are just coming out, who need a place to sleep that night, perhaps, who need immediately to get a job, who need to arrange housing, who need to actually reunify with perhaps family that they've become estranged from. These are things that are very important that criminal offenders need right when they come out. And so the reentry is very important, and really at the beginning to watch them and support them very carefully right when they get out and not wait too long, because that is the time when they are most vulnerable to reoffending or violating.
So if they manage to stay out of prison for a year after they've been released, then they generally make it?
Madam Chair, that is the truth, at least from our studies, and that's actually supported nationally as well. It's hard to believe, I'll say, really, and yet we have the studies ourselves, so... I guess I could... We had chosen about three of the policy recommendations to...
Before you begin there, I see Senator Michicki has a question.
Okay. So on that point, a year is clearly a significant milestone. Is there sort of an average period of time where typical recidivism occurs under a year? I mean, obviously, year is a mark. Is there sort of an average recidivism mark as well?
Through the chair, I don't know if I could call it an average, but a significant, I mean, almost all of the recidivism happens within the first 3 months. And then by the time you get to the year mark, I don't want to say the wrong number, but I think it's around 90%. So I'll have to check the exact number for you in the first 3 months, but I mean, it is really quite almost all of it.
Follow up. We have the health and social services budget, so we've just been looking at sort of the demographics of some of the folks in need, and we're focused on Department of Corrections, but for each repeat offender, you have DPS costs, you have Department of Law costs, you have corrections costs, you most likely have health and social services costs for the unincarcerated proportion of the family or remaining family members. Mm-hmm. You're hitting some major cost centers in the state, so it would be interesting to understand sort of an across-the-board cost to the state instead of focusing on one department. Recidivism is very expensive. When you think about the value of treatment, even if you're just focused on substance abuse, you almost have to pull those other departments into the analysis.
Through the chair, that would be a terrific analysis to do, I think. It would be hard to do, but it would be very worthwhile.
You can continue.
So I'll talk a little bit about this issue of limiting the use of prison for low-level misdemeanor offenders, something that, as some of you have commented, sort of has a high-level appeal, but you do worry about the low-level misdemeanor offenders who have, 20 prior low-level nonviolent misdemeanors. So the commission definitely heard a lot about these types of offenders. And as I mentioned before, but I think it's important to reiterate, what the commission heard, what the research shows, is that for these low-risk, low-level misdemeanor offenders, putting them in prison actually can make them worse. And I think this was, I've been in the, sort of observing the criminal justice field for longer than I would like to say, and this was a real eye-opener for me. I think it was an eye-opener for a number of commissioners that you could actually make people worse, although when you think about it, you start to understand a little bit. And somebody said to me, I like this analogy, that maybe you're putting the minnows with the sharks.
Senator Kakian?
So being part of the commission, I get to hear some of it, and some of it is if there's other ways of accountability, for example, ankle monitoring and maybe constant reporting, somebody may not lose their job, may not lose their housing, mm-hmm. may not lose their ability to have transportation. So those become huge factors as you move along. Mm-hmm. You take them out of society by putting them in jail at a point where they lose their ability to actually repair themselves. And so mm-hmm. that was one of the things I think that we got more and more surprising. Even on the reentry part, if Jeff Jesse was here, he'd talk to you about housing. He'd talk to you about being able to get to work, mm-hmm. Those types of things. And mm-hmm. so, but I think the tools on low-level people are hold them accountable. And we looked at a whole range of accountability issues, and I think you'll see them come find their way into a bill that will actually look at accountability that sometimes even the people themselves might rather just sit in jail, but there's an accountability that keeps them moving forward. So mm-hmm. I think using just seat time to change somebody's behavior found has not worked as well as other ways of accountability. So that was kind of the range of questions and issues that were brought up, just to let you know.
Thank you. Senator Wenikowski.
Did you at all look at people intentionally getting arrested so that they would have either medical care or a warm place to sleep or food? Does that factor in at all?
Through the chair, actually the commission did receive information about the anecdotal information. We don't have any statistical or data studies on that, but Commissioner Stanfill mentioned that in Fairbanks, that's sort of the received wisdom, that there are people who will go in and do that. And I think that goes exactly to what Senator Coghill was saying, that if people can't have assistance getting these other supports, they might actually go into prison. And I think it is important, though, again, it's not that these low-level offenders would be released to their own devices. That would be a mistake. The commission, there's no evidence to indicate that would be a good idea, but that they could be held accountable within the community, which is much less expensive and has the potential to rehabilitate a lot more than putting them in prison. So, again, therapeutic courts, we have them. They have been shown to be effective. They could be used more, electronic monitoring, other kinds of checking in with supervisors while the person can be looking for work. I think to Senator Michiki's point, reintegrating with family, family that they may have become estranged from, reintegrating with their obligations to pay child support or to support their family in other ways. These are important things that bring people back into the community and bring them back into productive life that can be supported, but it's difficult to do that when they're incarcerated. It's easier and more effective, less expensive to do that when they're in the community if we have the resources, again, if we have the resources, and that's a little bit of the reinvestment piece. Although some of the things we actually do have already.
Senator Michiki?
I don't want to take a lot of time, but I've been sort of immersed in this in the interim just interested, again, primarily with the HESS budget and treatment options. But I, 2 days before I came down, I sat through, I was allowed to attend a pretty intense group therapy session at Cicada, and was there for 3 hours. And they talked about some of the things they learned on the inside for folks that were sort of low-level substance abuse people that were incarcerated. They learned better skills at avoiding detection while they're using. They learned better skills at getting more contacts, at obtaining substances when they're released. And they learned much more effective illegal ways to earn money for their habit when they're released. And the of course, saddest thing about the whole thing is that the substances were often available inside anyway, which didn't decrease the debt from their family on trying to continue their habits, right? So it doesn't work. I mean, that's clear. That's not an effective way to deal with it. And I don't want to take a lot of time, but it was a fascinating 3 hours. And these were people that looked just like you or I. A couple had probably a few more piercings and tats, but aside from that, they were very nice people that had just taken the wrong turn and really didn't know how to get back.
Well, Madam Chair, maybe we didn't need to do all those studies. We could have asked Senator. it is interesting how your information on the ground, you know, turns out to be exactly the key. That's exactly what the commission heard. So that's very... That's very helpful.
Representative Kamen.
And anecdotally, I can echo that. I remember a client from some years ago who had a shoplifting in a cars in Anchorage, and when one looked at his rap sheet, I think there was this frequency that sometime in October or November, he seemed to get arrested again for shoplifting in a cars, and he got increasing longer and longer misdemeanor sentences, usually getting out sometime in the spring and then probably essentially functioned as a street person through the summer and then was back in the institution. And strictly from a cost standpoint, if the resources were in the community to recognize that he actually didn't really want to be living on the street in the colder months and this was just the only way he could get a warm bed, and that really isn't what we want to be doing, using our corrections dollars for. They're an expensive way to provide a warm bed. Mm-hmm. And that's one anecdote. I have many, but I won't go on at length, but I agree with all that's been observed.
Continue, please.
So I think, I mean, that it is a difficult problem, and it's a problem of, you know, how do you motivate individuals' behavior, and it's not easy. To the extent that others have found ways that have been proven to work most of the time, those are the ways that the commission is recommending. And as it turns out, those tend to be less expensive ways in the communities, provided that the services are there. Again, we don't want to be releasing these people without the types of support that they need. Let's see. I was going to talk about another recommendation. So we talked quite a bit about the risk assessment for pretrial defendants. I guess one thing that I was really interested to learn throughout this process is that if, as I understand it, if Alaska is able to pass a package, a significant reform package, additional technical assistance would be available to us, and that would be, as I understand it, free of charge to help us implement some of these recommendations. So I've been talking a lot about a pretrial risk assessment tool. That's something that doesn't exist yet for Alaska. It exists in other states, and it's being used. They are being used in other states. Any such tool would have to be, I guess you could say, normed for Alaska, or it would have to work for Alaska. And so that's one of the things that we would have to work on. It's not something that could be put into place immediately on July 1 or July 10 or something like that. So, but again, as I understand it, technical assistance would be available. And actually, Judicial Council staff's been in touch with one of the main foundations that provides creating these risk assessment tools in other states, and they've tentatively indicated a willingness to work with Alaska as well. So it's a lot of work, but I think the resources could be there for us to accomplish it. Let's see. I wanted to talk a little bit. We haven't talked too much about community supervision, and I wanted to talk a little bit about that. So one of the things that the commission received studies on that maybe in the category of things that we kind of already know is that if you're trying to control somebody's behavior, it's helpful to have a stick, but it's doubly helpful to have a carrot. So I think maybe we can all think of times with children or others that you want to have something to encourage people to good behavior as well as a consequence for if they don't behave. And one of the tools that could be really strengthened for Department of Corrections is this carrot piece of the equation when they're supervising people. So, and also when people are on probation, could a defendant an offender who's on probation, could they be incentivized to complete all the tasks that they have to complete by being given compliance credits? In other words, if you do the things you need to do, if you pay restitution, if you seek treatment, if you pay fines, whatever else may be on the list of things they've got to do, could they be rewarded by getting off of probation more quickly? And this has, if you think about it, this then would have sort of a domino effect that the ones who could and would comply quickly would be off probation a little bit faster. And that would be one less person on that probation officer's caseload, and then that probation officer could focus more closely on the ones who aren't so compliant. So this is something that's, I guess in the category of common sense, but also supported by the data and the research. And so that is one of the recommendations, that there could be compliance credits for people who are out on supervision who need to get busy, who need to do some things for their own rehabilitation and also for the restoration of society, like paying fines or restitution. And they need to get busy. And right now we have this method of penalizing them, but we don't have to have the carrot necessarily. So that's the commission has recommended that. That's their recommendation number 14.
When somebody is out on a probation, how often are they required to see their probation officer?
Madam Chair, I don't know the answer to that. I have the idea that it varies a bit depending on the circumstances, but I don't know.
I guess I'm wondering whether or not the very act of seeing the probation officer, whether or not it's counterproductive to they're trying to hold a job. Not that I'm suggesting that there shouldn't be any probation officers, but I'm wondering whether what sort of flexibility there is as far as scheduling appointments if somebody is holding a job.
Madam Chair, I don't really know the answer to that, although you certainly hear about people being quote-unquote over-programmed. They have so many appointments to go to that it's difficult to do what they need to do.
Representative Clayman?
Again, anecdotally, I can provide some insight there. Unless, and I see Mr. Steiner's in the office. If I'm off, you can correct me. But I know there's a range of both parole and probation programs, and some are kind of, they have an intensive release program that sometimes is actually daily meetings with the probation officers for people that are higher at risk for reoffending, and that can be taking drug tests every day in the early stages, and then as it gets better, they ease back on how frequently they have to give drug tests or how often they have to come, and there will be other people that get released, and they might only have once a week or once every other week, and as they improve, it goes down to even once a month. But there are certainly plenty of stories. I know we had a bill last year that was before this committee that addressed the issue about essentially trying to have people who have jobs who are on probation or parole and their check-in requirements that was actually limiting some of their ability to have jobs that would have them working out of the communities where their probation officer worked. And so there's a whole range of settings and frequency of probation check-ins, and it's definitely times in which those opportunities, those requirements may get in the way of their work opportunities, and there has to be some flexibility for that, but at the same time, the work can't be an excuse to, oh, I can never see you again as my probation officer. So it's a challenge of trying to work a system, because there are certainly offenders, to keep them from that reoffending within 1 year, you need intensive supervision, especially early on, but the reward system would suggest if you're doing better, you won't have to see me as often.
Senator Coghill.
I think, Madam Chair, when you get the chance to get to the report, if you look under sections 5 through 11, no, I'm sorry, 12 through 18, you're going to find that what they talked about is tools that give better risk and needs assessments in programs, and then you're going to talk about how you supervise the higher risk at a different way, how you get that earned good time credit on probation. So I think what we're going to see, and part of the justice reinvestment here is in reinvesting in some of those things, but also it'll be decreasing the probation parole load. Mm-hmm. So I think you'll see that risk assessment tool probably show you a better way of doing a management of people within that system. Mm-hmm. So we don't have to then pump up how many probation officers we have, but we really just take care of the people who are the highest risk first and then move along in that way. So I think you'll see some ways to encourage good behavior, hold people accountable, and then you'll see a couple of tweaks in there, including even capping some of the ways you can PTRP people and hold them accountable a little differently. So, and I used an acronym, petition to revoke bail, I think, or probation. So I think you're going to see in the recommendations some very thoughtful things. So.
Thank you. Continue.
Madam Chair, actually,
I guess we have one more question from Senator Michicki before you continue.
So I may be a bit naive. These are assumptions I make that folks offend. We all do silly things when we're young, right? That folks likely, the average person offends more as a young person, but many of them have a high potential for turning their lives around and actually succeeding. Does corrections have a system of applying a probability of success with incarcerated individuals as opposed to those that, and I don't mean about picking winners and losers, but there are folks that you can see responding to treatment and sort of turning their lives around before your eyes, right? Mm-hmm. Where some of those credits might actually end up in a very productive individual that can be proud of what they're doing in their lives, support their family, move on, and leave it all behind. Does corrections invest in that kind of ranking to provide more support for someone with a higher probability of success? And I hate to use any other word, because that's kind of what it's about.
Madam Chair, I don't really know the answer to that. I guess the closest thing that I do know is that Department of Corrections does perform these risk assessments on the people within their population. And it's quite interesting. I think 40%, around 40% of the people that it assesses are deemed low risk. And again, that's that sort of that concept of how likely is that person to reoffend, which is a little bit different than what you were talking about, which is how likely is that person to succeed or to reform or rehabilitate himself. But, I mean, I think that would be maybe the closest thing that I know of. And so I think Corrections in the state is really more invested now in trying to really systematically assess people for the likelihood, and it's not perfect, it's statistics, but the likelihood of reoffending. And one of the tools that the commission recommended that Senator Coghill alluded to is on the stick side of things, not the carrot, but the stick side of things, for people who do violate. It's very interesting. The commission received information that people who are going in on a supervision violation were spending, I think, around on an average 106 days back incarcerated for each violation, which is kind of a long time, especially in light of evidence which shows that they don't really need to spend that long. They do need to be held accountable, but actually disrupting a person quickly, bringing them back to prison for maybe a day or 2 days or 3 days or 4 days, as long as it can be done swiftly and certainly, so they know, you know, it's like you would not say to your child, if you do that bad behavior, there's a 50% chance that in 6 months I will issue a consequence, but I'm not telling you what that consequence is. That is not the way you do it. You say, if you do this bad behavior, there's a 100% chance that that I will issue a consequence tomorrow, and the consequence will be A. And so that is the principle of swift, certain, and proportional really reactions. And so for the ones who come out on supervision who get off on the wrong foot, jerk them back very quickly, get them in there, get their attention, and then get them back out, let them try again. If they mess up again, they come back for a little longer this time. And in that way, which is maybe, I guess you could almost say trial and error, it's maybe the best way we know how right now, they sort themselves out. For the ones who learned after that first consequence, and the ones who really needed a few more consequences to get the idea. So that's one of the principles that the commission recommends supporting.
And proceed.
Well, Madam Chair, that was the end of my prepared remarks, but I certainly... I'm so sorry that Commissioner Jesse couldn't be here to talk to you. I know that he would have done a much better job than I, and it would have been terrific for you to hear from him his own personal reactions to the commission process. I certainly have heard a lot of commissioners talk about it and how amazing it was to really how intense it was to come together with so much information and really struggle over these very complicated and uncertain issues that the state has been struggling with. It's not just us. Many states have been struggling. There are no real simple answers, but these are the best answers that the commission could come up with. They've been vetted. They've been discussed with many, many different stakeholders. They've been discussed very thoroughly and with great emotion and caring in the commission meetings. And I think the amazing thing, we've got 21 consensus recommendations that all those various people from all those different perspectives could agree on. And I guess we will wait to have the recommendations in the bill.
Well, thank you very much. I think you did a fine job of substituting. Is there anybody on the committee who has any questions or wants to make any additional comments? Senator Coghill?
This is a commission member. I'll speak. Many 50-some meetings, if I remember correctly, broken down into subgroups. And these are busy, busy people. These are judges, law enforcement people. The Greg Razzo, who came from the Native Corporation, literally spent hours and hours and hours away from work doing these things, and so did everybody else. And yet, a real willingness to roll up the sleeves, tackle it, you know, getting people who have very disparate views and really sometimes contradictory functions in life had to sit down and say, how would this work? So I'd say, and just like we do here, you can talk about this policy, but it affects so many other policies. So try to stay focused was really a major task, and so Judicial Council did it very well. One of the other things that I think the Judicial Council brings to the table is they are part of a criminal justice working group that talks about probably court management, police interventions, and things like that. But they're not a policy body they don't recommend policies. So when the commission came in, many of the same discussions had already been happening, but this is a way to filter them up to policy calls. And so the other thing is, as with everything, these are recommendations that are consensus items that necessarily, when you have a consensus, when you get them down to the details, you're going to find that we're going to have to noodle our way through these policy calls to make sure that they work at a technical level. So we're going to be asking, how does that work now, you know, over and over and over again. But I'm just going to, at a high level, you got pretrial, sentencing issues for prisons for violence, supervision intervention, oversight and accountability, which, by the way, have two very different functions, and then the reinvestment. Those areas fall into the first four items are pretrial, 5 through 11 are the prison for violent versus nonviolent, 12 through 18 deal with supervision interventions, and then oversight and accountability, very, very different approach, 19 through 21, and reinvestment then follow on. A prison bed costs about $140-some a night. Depending on where you're at, those numbers float. If we can say save that bed and reinvest $50, $80, and we have better safety outcomes, then I think that's a good focus. And so as the report shows, we're trying to look at it in a body of thought. And I just wanted to speak up for the commission members who really volunteered huge amount of time and did not have a problem arguing with each other pretty intently. So I think many of the recommendations, as they came to a consensus, necessarily had to be a little higher level than what we are going to work at when we get in committee and hammer out word by word the issue. So I just wanted to set that conversation up. Thank you.
And I, as Judiciary Chairman, I'm very, very looking forward to working on this bill. I think that this bill may be one of the most important things that we do in the Judiciary Committee, and perhaps one of the most important things that we do in the legislature. So if no one else has any comment, Representative Grunberg.
Just a thought, and I don't know if it's in here, but one thing that I hear running through this is what the senator just said, which is seeing what works. And maybe as we're doing this kind of stuff, we should, as legislators, focus a little bit on that so that we have feedback and we have a chance to readjust or change things as we're going along. And provisions in some of these bills that would require some reporting and maybe sunset clauses or something like that. I'm looking at it from our side of the table. What can we do as legislators to help make the system work? And I'm looking forward to really reading this, but I would just ask, maybe that's the kind of thing. It'll take a little more follow-through, but it may yield some good results. Through the chair, what do you think?
Madam Chair, actually, I'm really glad you asked that question. It's one thing that I neglected to talk about. From my perspective as a researcher, one of the most important recommendations of the report is that there be an accountability and oversight body established, because if the legislature were to make these changes, which are significant, the state is entitled to basically get the better outcomes promised, and we have to monitor to find out whether they're working or not. And it would be wrong. I mean, it would be very, very sad to enact these significant changes and then not have a way of deciding, hey, are we really getting those prison bed reductions that were predicted? Hey, you know, what is happening with those offenders, those low-level offenders who aren't spending as long in prison? Are they really getting some services, or did we make that revolving door go faster, or did we really sort of stop it? Those are extremely important things to keep track of, and the report actually recommends establishing some performance measures. So what are the things we'd like to see happening? Which way do we want to see the numbers moving? And establishing those measures and collecting information and reporting back to you, to the legislature, and to the governor on how it's going. And then really to monitor, and also when things don't go well, because, of course, you know, our best intentions aside, sometimes we do things that have unintended consequences, and it'd be extremely important to monitor that situation to find out, are there some unintended consequences? And if so, the oversight body, whether it be the commission or some other body, would want to communicate that to you all so that tweaks or adjustments could be made in the law, in the package that you passed. So that's a very important part of the recommendations. This isn't, as Lieutenant Sell says, a one and done. This is an ongoing process, and you know, she and the other commissioners are very committed to this, to the success of these recommendations.
Thank you. Senator McGuire.
Thank you, and I appreciate all the work that you have done, Suzanne, in working with our office and the Senate as well. We also stand committed to working on these issues, as you know. I would just, as you're moving forward, I think lawmakers get very inundated with reports and even executive summaries of reports, and I think this is a good start. But as you move toward educating lawmakers, trying to think about, out of the 21, these discrete categories, what the goal is and what some of the concrete decisions that can be made today are. The idea that you had about a pilot project that would go ahead and do a screening of those who are higher risk in a pretrial status, that's a concrete recommendation that has some proven success behind it in other states. Mm-hmm. Make sure the lawmaker can see that link and what the dollar amount is and what decision we need to make that. And I guess what I want to say is this is a very ethereal concept. I think everyone here on this committee would agree that we spend too much, that for what we spend, the results are not good from both a cost point of view and a humanistic point of view, that we know we need to make changes. But then when you start getting into the details over the last 15 years, I think that's where people go off. Mm-hmm. And then you can end up in political debates over things like, are you pro-victim or are you pro-crime or are you pro-defendant? Are you too soft on crime or too hard? And I think if you can narrow it down and begin to slow roll over a period of 3 years, concrete recommendations that have data behind them, and then what is your ask specifically, I think you're going to get there. And the one example I wanted to give members is the 24/7 program. This is something that, you know, a decade ago, I remember the first time this notion was proposed, and the legislature, both sides of the aisle, were like, wow, that's too risky. We're not going to allow people who have had drug and alcohol violations out on an ankle monitor. What if something happens? And what we've seen in that program is actually like 99% success, mm-hmm. right? And it's a data-driven process that can be recorded, and you can see when they check in, mm-hmm. they're sober, they're keeping a job, life is moving forward. And if you can move them through that period, you don't have the recidivism. So I just look to that as an example of where we've taken a political risk, but it's now assigned to actual data, and I would build on those kinds of things so that you have more success at the front end before you start taking these bigger philosophical risks. Just my thought.
Thank you. Anyone else? Well, then, this meeting is adjourned. It is 10 minutes to 3:00.